This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Just back from the American Academy for the Advancement of Science Annual Conference 2012, this is Alex Smith. I've recorded two of the best speeches of the weekend gathering of thousands of scientists held this year in Vancouver, Canada. You will hear presentations by NASA climate scientist James Hansen and best-selling author and science writer Chris Mooney. Dr. James Hansen, head of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, warns it isn't enough to reduce our emissions. We must actually take carbon dioxide back out of the air to avoid entering a new and dangerous age of greenhouse living. We are currently at 390 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere and rising rapidly. The target, Hansen says, is 350 parts per million. That is the level where the polar ice, which regulates the climate humans have known for the past 10,000 years, will remain on planet Earth. Chris Mooney, author of The Republican War on Science, says scientists fail to communicate the danger of climate change because they wrongly believe mere facts will convince the public. Instead, Mooney outlines studies showing humans use facts to bolster pre-existing beliefs about the world, and there are large differences in the basic personalities of those who gravitate towards the right and the left of politics. We get a sneak preview from his new book. Both are short recordings from the AAAS symposium titled Climate Solutions, The Challenges of Getting to 350. They were recorded by Alex Smith on Sunday, February 19, 2012. Here is famed climate scientist Dr. James Hansen.
Let me go right to my first chart. So this is the global temperature the past century, and there's now no disagreement that the world has warmed up about 8/10 of a degree Celsius over this time period. Even the skeptical scientists now agree with that. And that's putting us already beginning to move outside the range of the Holocene. Civilization developed during the Holocene, the last 10 to 12,000 years of relatively stable climate. These are curves for the temperatures estimated at different places on the Earth's surface, multiplied by factors to make the curves approximate the global mean temperature change. So the polar regions, for example, the top of the Antarctic ice sheet, the temperature changes are typically twice as large as on the global average. So they're multiplied by 0.5. But you can see that over the last 8 or 10,000 years, the temperature has been relatively constant. And we now, we can say with a pretty high degree of confidence that we've already moved out of the Holocene range, because these are graphs of the mass balance of the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets and measured very precisely by the gravity satellite GRACE. And what it shows is that both hemispheres, the ice sheets, are now losing mass, and the rate at which they're losing mass is accelerating over the period of the data, which began to be measured in the late 2002. They're now losing mass at a rate of a few hundred cubic kilometers per year, and sea level is going up at a rate of more than 3 millimeters a year, which is more than 3 meters per millennium. And if we compare this to the Holocene, sea level has been very stable within about a meter or so over the entire past several thousand years. So we're now already at a point where it must be a bit warmer than the prior Holocene maximum. This is the temperature over the past 5 million years on the top graph, and then it's expanded over the last 800,000 years in the bottom graph. And the zero point on the temperature scale is the 1880 to 1920 mean, with the assumption the modern temperature record is attached to this temperature record, which is extracted from microscopic shelled animals that lived in the deep ocean and deposited their shells on the ocean floor. But from those, we can get an estimate of the temperature variation over this time period. And you see that Now that the temperature is at about 8/10 of a degree Celsius, it's not quite as warm as the last interglacial, which was probably about, according to this record, about 1.2 degrees Celsius. So we're still about half a degree cooler than the last interglacial period. But we're only about 1 degree cooler than the early to mid Pliocene, when sea level was 15 to 25 meters higher. So if that gives you an idea of the limitation, even if we go to 2 degrees Celsius warming relative to 1880 to 1920, we will be pushing the climate toward eventual sea levels of tens of meters higher than what it is now. We can't say how long it would take to come to that new equilibrium if we brought the planet to 2 degrees warmer, but we know where it would be headed. And in my opinion, we could expect multi-meter sea level rise this century. That's one of the criterias for helping us estimate what is the level of greenhouse gases that we should aim for. Another one is another irreversible effect, practically irreversible on any timescale that humans can imagine, is the extermination of species. And we're already putting a lot of pressure on many species. And if we go with business as usual for the rest of this century, the estimates are that 20 to 50% of the species on the planet would be ticketed for extinction. But it's not only these long-term effects that we need to be concerned about. The climate already is changing. This graph on the left is the frequency of occurrence of summer mean, June, July, August temperature anomalies relative to the 1951 to 1980 mean climate. And that's an appropriate base period to use because that's still within the Holocene, which is the period to which the biology on the planet is adapted, life on the planet is adapted. And we can see that we have the curves for this frequency distribution for different decades, the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. Those three decades all have the bell curve, the normal distribution for the distribution of anomalies. But now you see in the last few decades that distribution has been shifting to the right. And not only is it shifting, but it's getting broader. So you can see that there now is a significant chance of having a 3-sigma, 3-standard deviation anomaly, which if you go back to the period of climatology, a 3-sigma deviation occurred about 2 to 3 tenths of 1% of the time. Well, it's now more like 10% of the time. These are maps of the anomalies in units of standard deviation. So the three sigma anomalies are the dark brown. And if you look in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, they hardly occurred at all. But now in the last few years, they've been occurring over about 10% of the land area. So in 2011, Texas and Oklahoma and northern Mexico had a 3-sigma anomaly. And the prior year, 2010, Eastern Europe and Western Asia had an anomaly, a 3-standard deviation anomaly. That was what was hitting Moscow a year ago. So those anomalies are now, you can say with a high degree of confidence that, in fact, those extreme conditions in Texas and Oklahoma and Moscow are attributable to the global warming because their chances of occurring were minuscule prior to that warming. And that's an indication of what's to come if we stay on business as usual. This happens to be computer simulations of the likelihood of extreme summer droughts from the ECMWF climate model, but it just shows these regions in southern Europe and Mexico and the Midwest of the United States, there's a danger that that breadbasket of the country or breadbasket of the world really will be plagued by extreme droughts if we stay on a business as usual course. Now, there are a number in longer presentations, I can give you a lot of reasons why it makes sense that the maximum level of CO2 that we should aim for on the long run is no more than 350 ppm. But we can quantify that quite precisely by looking at the planet's energy imbalance. This shows, this is a graph of the solar irradiance over the last few decades, the period in which it's been accurately measured from satellites. And what we'd like to know is the planet's energy balance or imbalance. And finally, with the deployment of the Argo floats, of more than 3,000 floats around the world's ocean, which measure the temperature and thus the heat content of the ocean to a depth of 2 kilometers, we finally have a reasonably accurate estimate of the rate at which the heat content of the ocean is changing. And what we find over this period in which we have the most accurate data, the last 6 years, is that during that period, the ocean is gaining heat at a rate of about 4/10 of a watt per meter squared averaged over the planet. And when you add in the amount of energy that's going into melting of ice, the reduction in the size of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets and the mountain glaciers, and the heat going into the atmosphere and the ground, it's about an imbalance of about 6/10 of a watt per meter squared. And that's occurring during the solar minimum. So if the sun were driving the system, then during the solar minimum, you should have less energy coming in than you have going out. But in fact, there's more energy coming in because of the greenhouse effect of the added gases. And the imbalance is about 6/10 of a watt. So averaged over the solar cycle, the imbalance is probably more like 3/4 of a watt. For if the imbalance is 0.5 watt and you wanted to restore the planet's energy balance, keeping other things fixed, you would have to reduce CO2 from 391 ppm to about 360 ppm. If the imbalance is 3/4 of a watt, you have to reduce CO2 to 345 ppm. So that's very consistent with our estimate that we'd made a few years ago, that you need to get back to about 350 ppm. You know, if we put a pulse of CO2 in the atmosphere by burning fossil fuels or otherwise, the atmospheric amount will decline over time as that CO2 gets mixed among the surface reservoirs, especially going into the ocean. And after 100 years, only about 18% of that pulse is still in the atmosphere. But most of that will stay in the atmosphere for millennia until it's finally deposited on the ocean floor as carbonates by the weathering process. But it's important to note that the same thing is true for a negative CO2. If you decide we've passed the safe amount of CO2 and so we're going to suck some out of the atmosphere by whatever means and then store it, if you suck out 100 ppm, well, the effectiveness of that will decline over time because the ocean will then feel, oh, there's less CO2 in the atmosphere, so it will start degassing CO2. So the same curve applies to a negative. So if you want to suck the CO2 out, you've got and have it stay that change remain for 100 years, you've got to take out about 6 times more than the decrement that you want to get. So geoengineering in that way is going to be extremely difficult. And in fact, with today's costs, if you had to take 50 ppm out of the atmosphere, the cost would be a few $100 trillion at the current, with current technologies for trying to get CO2 out of the atmosphere. You may be able to reduce that by a factor of a few, conceivably even an order of magnitude, but then you're still talking about tens of trillions of dollars just to get 50 ppm out of the atmosphere and then figure out what you're going to do with it.
We are listening to top NASA scientist James Hansen, recorded by Radio EcoShock at the 2012 annual meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science at AAAS.org.
On the other hand, it's not impossible to get back to 350 ppm. If we stopped emitting CO2. If we stopped burning fossil fuels in 2015, we would go back to 350 ppm about the end of the century. If we waited until 2050, it would still be over 400 ppm for several centuries. But if we also assume that we could reforest and we could store in forests and the soil 100 gigatons of carbon, that would be essentially, that's about the total amount of deforestation that has occurred over the last few centuries. So it would have to restore forests to comparable to what they were earlier. But I think that's barely conceivable, because you could also get some of the carbon to go into the soil, biochar and other techniques. So I think with a really a massive effort that you could perhaps get 100 gigaton uptake of CO2 by the soils and the biosphere. In that case, if you reduced CO2 emissions 6% per year beginning next year, then you would get back to 350 ppm at about the end of this century. If you wait until 2030, then you'll stay above 350 for several, about 500 years or so. But you would get back to, less than 400 ppm by early next century. And you can see what the other cases are. If you did this 6% per year reduction in emissions, then temperature would peak at about 1.1 or 1.2 degrees Celsius above the 1880 to 1950 average. So that would be that peak would be approximately the Eemian climate 130,000 years ago. And then it would cool off, and in 100 years or so, it would be back to the temperature of today. But if you wait until 2045 before you begin to reduce emissions, then you're going to get a peak of about 2 degrees, which is the Pliocene, early Pliocene type temperatures. And so the basic fact is that what we've burned so far of oil, gas, and coal is the purple parts of these estimated reserves and potentially recoverable resources. So the fact is, we cannot burn all of the coal, and we cannot burn the unconventional oil, tar sands and tar shale, without putting the planet on a course to practically the ice-free planet with sea level 70 meters above what it is, although we can't say how long it would take to get there, but we would have a continually changing climate with unstable shorelines. So it's possible to get to less than 350 ppm, but we can't burn the coal, all the coal or the unconventional. What's actually happening is governments all around the world are going after every fossil fuel they can find, just completely ignoring the science. Is it an economics matter? But I say it's not one for bankers or economists. And I'm talking not talking about good economists like the one we have on the panel this morning. I'm talking about the economists who are on the who go through this revolving door between Wall Street and the White House and favor big banks. What we need, fossil fuels, we keep going after them because they're the cheapest energy. They're cheapest only because they're subsidized and they don't pay their costs to society. Huge impact on human health, which is extremely expensive, and all of that is borne by the public. All of the air and water pollution effects are borne by the public. And they don't have to pay for their cost, climate cost, the impacts they will have on future generations. So what we should do, we need to have regulations on efficiency and we need to have technology development, but the principal thing that needs to underlie that is a fee on carbon, which should be collected from fossil fuel companies at the source, at the domestic mine or the port of entry. And that's what's needed both to affect consumer choices over coming years and to affect businesses and create innovations for carbon-free energy. And unlike cap and trade, which is designed There's absolutely no value of the banks added to this problem. We don't want a cap-and-trade system with fluctuating prices. We want to know that the prices are going to continue to go up. The consumer needs to know that. Industry needs to know that. And the cap-and-trade system, the Kyoto Protocol approach, is very ineffective. You don't need to try to read this, but this is something written by the head of the Republicans for Environmental Protection, and his bottom line in describing this fee and dividend approach is that it's transparent, market-based, does not enlarge the government, and leaves money decisions to the public. And he says that's a conservative climate plan. And finally, I don't have time to talk about the fact that it's a matter of intergenerational injustice if we don't begin to take actions to phase down carbon emissions. But you all know that parents have always been willing to sacrifice for their children, and they certainly would not allow us to continue on this course if they understood the matter. But it's very difficult to communicate with the public because of the huge influence that the fossil fuel industry has on the public discussion. I think I've used my time. Thanks.
You just heard Dr. James Hansen of NASA, recorded at the annual meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science in Vancouver, February 19, 2012. We'll go straight to his answers to questions from the audience, mainly scientists and science writers from around the world. First question, what price should we put on carbon?
A good rate, I think, would be that which was proposed by Congressman John Larson in the United States, which was $15 a ton the first year of a ton of CO2, going up $10 a ton each year. So at the end of 10 years, it's $115 a ton. That is equal to $1 a gallon of gasoline. And that would generate, in the United States, given the fossil fuel use the past few years, it would generate $600 billion per year at the end of 10 years, which would be between $2,000 and $3,000 per legal resident of the country, assuming that you give only half a share to children, up to two per family. And that would mean so between $6,000 and $9,000 per year for a family with two or more children. So they would have increased energy costs where they're using fossil fuels or products that are made with fossil fuels, but they would have this monthly dividend, which could be distributed electronically to their bank account or, if they don't have one, to their debit card. And it's just a very simple system. And more than 60% of the people with the current distribution of energy use, more than 60% of the people would get more in the dividend than they get in increased energy prices. But in order for them to stay on that positive side of the ledger, they would have to make their decisions over time because this rate is going to continue to go up. So they would need to, the next time they buy a vehicle, they may want to get one that's more efficient, and they may want to do other things to reduce their carbon footprint. But it's something that would be noticed, but you need that. If you want to drive lifestyle choices and if you want to provide the incentive for innovations, then you need to have a significant price. So that's why when they had this debate in Congress in the United States a couple of years ago, they were trying to pretend that this wouldn't affect energy prices. Well, if it doesn't affect energy prices, it's not going to work. It has to be significant. So that's an example. And by the way, that particular rate at the end of 10 years, according to the economic models that it's been run through, would reduce U.S. emissions 30% at the end of 10 years. A large part of that from energy efficiency changes as people see that there's a cost. But 30% of U.S. fossil fuel use is 13 times greater than the capacity of the Keystone XL pipeline. It would make such a pipeline superfluous. We wouldn't need it.
The next question for climate scientist Dr. James Hansen. In your book, Storms of Our Grandchildren, you also talked about other warming agents like methane and black carbon. What do you say about them now?
These short-lived climate forcers like methane and black carbon You can get some reduction of the planet's energy imbalance by addressing those. I think we probably need that in order to counteract the effect of reduction of sulfates, which is going to occur over time. As people, as India and China and countries don't like their air pollution, they're going to start finding ways to reduce that particulate air pollution, which is going to aggravate the climate problem. But I think if we pay close attention to trying to reduce these other forcings, we may be able to balance that. But what we have to remember is that the fundamental issue is the CO2 because its timescale is millennia. And as I showed on the one chart, you know, although some of it seems to be disappearing quite quickly, it's because it's going in the ocean, but it's not going to disappear. A good fraction of it, about a fifth or a sixth, will stay in the atmosphere for an extremely long time. And so that's really the thing we have to address. And once the people understand that we've got an emergency, then those short-lived things we can address pretty quickly because the CO2 is going to take time. So I don't emphasize those short-lived ones because the fundamental problem is the CO2.
Next question for James Hansen. Can we say recent weather events are caused by global warming? Note that 3-sigma events are those which are 3 deviations beyond the normal, the point which is beyond being caused by chance.
Yeah, you can't attribute where it occurred because the weather patterns are really quite chaotic or stochastic. But the fact that their frequency of 3-sigma anomalies has increased by more than an order of magnitude means that for all practical purposes, you could say the chances of that happening without the global warming would have been almost negligibly small. So, yeah, I think scientists have had to be overcautious on this. And I'm not, however, talking about hurricanes, which is a more complicated story, because there are impacts on hurricanes that work both ways. But in terms of these heat waves, we can say with a very high degree of confidence.
Our final quote from James Hansen comes from the Q&A session. He talks about why the money raised by carbon taxes must go directly back to the public rather than the government in his proposed fee and dividend system.
It's very difficult to get anything in and sustain it and have it continue to increase if it is just something coming out of the public's pocket, even if it's being used for a good thing. So, for example, Al Gore tried to get a 5-cent gallon tax on gasoline. He couldn't do it. It's very hard to do. That's why I say you have to give the money to the public. And when they see on a monthly basis that they're getting this amount of money, and as I say, more than 60%, given the current distribution of energy use, of carbon energy use, 60% of the people would get more in their monthly dividend. That, I think, is essential if you want to have that price continue to go up. But what I see happening is as soon as we convince a politician that this is a good idea, then they start thinking, how will we use that money? And if I decide to spend any of my time on the non-science instead of the science promoting what I think is a solution, I'm going to say you've got to convince the public to say 100% or fight. We want 100% of that money back to us. Don't you decide on how to use it. Because as soon as you start giving it away, it will go away quickly, and then the public will not be behind a rising carbon tax or carbon fee, whatever you call it. I just think this is a very important point. And yet, just the nature of politicians, I've gone into their offices, you know, and they immediately think, that's a good idea. And now there's this Citizens Climate Lobby, which is saying it's going to have one goal, and that's to promote fee and dividend. But already when they go to congressmen's offices and sit with them and try to tell them about this idea. But then the congressman comes back and says, we should use 50% of this to reduce the national debt. And most people would agree that's a good thing to do. But that's just making it another tax. I don't think we should. I think you have to have Tea Party determination and Tea Party discipline. You've got to say 100% or fight. That's my opinion.
That was Dr. James Hansen, director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. My thanks to the American Academy for the Advancement of Science for allowing me to record this talk on February 19th, 2012. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Stay tuned for the witty explanation by science writer Chris Mooney about educated idiots and why people deny global warming science.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
Why does the American network Fox News use every snowstorm to deny the world is warming? Chris Mooney is author of four books, including The Republican War on Science. He's a widely published science writer, appears on TV, and helps educate scientists on how to communicate better. This is Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. I recorded this speech by Chris Mooney at the annual meeting of the AAAS, the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, in Vancouver, February 19, 2012. You'll also get a sneak peek into his new book. This is Chris Mooney in an event titled Climate Solutions, the Challenges of Getting to 350.
Thank you for including me. It's an honor to be on a panel with Jim Hansen, obviously one of our heroes in climate communication. So in addressing this massive problem of how do we get the climate system back in the safe zone, I've been called upon to focus on the issue of science communication and also the problem of science denial. And to understand both of these, first you have to think about science denial as not being very different from the denial of reality in general. And that's why I use this. And second, I'm going to contend that to really get what's going on here, you have to understand the politically conservative psychological processes we're dealing with and what is driving them. So my chief argument, which I'll elaborate on in the next 20 minutes, is that to get our communications right, and to understand, just to understand our current state of dysfunction, fiddling while the planet burns, we have to advance two scientific projects. One, the science of science communication. And two, the science of the left, the right, and the denial of reality. And we've made some progress in both areas, but there is a long way yet to go. Another way of framing the issue is, how do you explain this? Fox News, how do you explain it? What is it? It uses every new snowstorm as an excuse to sow doubt about global warming. And Fox News viewers have been shown in repeated studies to be more misinformed. Fox News increases your risk of being wrong about global warming. All right? How could that be? How could this exist? My contention is we can't understand such a phenomenon without looking at the deepest psychological motivations behind climate denial behavior as epitomized on Fox News. And that also is going to include looking at our own motivations and why they are so different from theirs. We have to understand ourselves, too. I'm going to be previewing information from my latest book in this. It's called The Republican Brain, The Science of Why They Deny Science and Reality. And it's controversial. So I've actually linked on my blog, scienceprogressaction.org/intersection, 18 published peer-reviewed studies showing differences between liberals and conservatives. You can go read them if you don't believe me. I'm actually reporting on mainstream research, but it's controversial. I used to misunderstand political conservatives and why they deny reality. I wrote a book about it. It wasn't wrong, but it didn't see everything. And this was 7 years ago now, and I've been learning a lot more ever since then. I approached communicating on this topic originally like a scientist does, you know, in the old Enlightenment mode. I went on tour, and I was going to explain, they're wrong about science. They're misrepresenting science. Here's what the scientists say. I've interviewed them. Here are the facts, and here are the misrepresentations, and here's why it's wrong. Do you think that this convinced conservatives? Why did I think it would? But I wasn't speaking to audiences of conservatives, was I? I was speaking to audiences like you. And I didn't think then also about why my audiences would be so self-selected. But my manner of communicating to them had a predictable effect. It made you angry. It made you really upset at all this misinformation in public life, all these crimes against science in your own government. This was the Bush administration. At the end of the talk, all of your hands would go up and you'd say, oh, what can I do You've made me very angry, Chris. You've made me want to punch a wall about all this bad science and science abuse and denial. What can I do about the problem? And I realized my instinctual answer to that question, which was you can go buy my book, was not enough, not adequate. And so the next 7 years are really a variety of ways of thinking about understanding what's really going on here. And that's led to a lot of efforts. One of them is pushing scientists to communicate better, right? And I think we can all agree that that's important. And I've actually been involved in actively training them to communicate. This is a picture from one of our NSF science communication trainings at Mississippi State. We've done almost a dozen now across the country. We've trained over 1,000 scientists. I think we're getting good at this. I'm very proud of it. But as time passed, that wasn't enough either, I think. I couldn't fail to notice that the problem of denying science, denying reality in America was not getting better. It is getting worse. Global warming denial, which is our chief focus here, has gotten more monolithic on the political right as the science has gotten more clearly defined, more solid, and the crisis more urgent. Paradoxically, or maybe not paradoxically if we really understand what we're dealing with. But how could something like that happen? Well, here are my answers on both of these fronts, and I'm going to use a wordy slide, okay? Because I know you guys like wordy slides. One, the communication war within science is mostly over. The good guys won. Okay? We don't have to fight anymore about it. But we have not reached the public. So from now on, if we're going to be effective, science communication has to be rooted in the science of science communication, to quote Yale's Dan Kahan. One of the revelations from the science of science communication is the scientific evidence shows that scientific evidence alone is rarely sufficient to change minds. You must accept this, QED. The evidence also shows that liberals and conservatives are just different people, and scientists are mostly psychological liberals. You therefore cannot trust your instincts in communication. They are wrong. What you think you're doing is not right. Well, maybe some of you have gotten past that, but the instinct is not right. The great strength of scientists is their willingness to listen to evidence and change their ways. That's what you have to go on. So let's get moving and, paradoxically, let's stay the course. So start with the good news. The communication war within science is mostly over. The good guys won. What do I mean by that? It used to be that when people like me would try to rally scientists to be better communicators, we'd get all this blowback. We would hear, that's not our job. It's the job of you journalists. Why are you trying to give us one extra thing to do? We teach. We do research. We apply for grants. And now you want us to communicate as well. And people would remember the story of Carl Sagan and how he actually was attacked by his colleagues for being such a good communicator. There were even attacks on the scientific research showing that things like framing work, okay? It's kind of obvious, but this was controversial. The idea that we should frame scientific information because it would go down easier for some audiences was controversial in 2007. But within a short period of time, and this is why I love you guys, you looked at the evidence, you changed your mind, and all of this is now pretty accepted, and everybody wants to be what we call at NSF a deadly ninja of science communication. You're all into it. Minds have changed extraordinarily fast, and that's a good thing. We still get some resistance to this idea of more scientific communication and outreach. We still get negativity on scientists using social media and blogging. They're afraid somehow that they're going to spend the rest of their days in front of a screen wearing only their underwear, playing whack-a-mole, with science deniers. But we're going to pass that hurdle too. They're going to eventually accept those skills too. We've come a long way in a short time in this science communication endeavor. But so far, the science communication outreach endeavor, at least that I'm a part of, and I think I speak for a lot of the science communication training that's going on, is largely focused on what I would call the practical, the how-to. And that includes things like, teaching scientists how to design a message in a strategic way, not to data dump, not to go on too long. Jargon busting. You cannot use words that your audience does not understand. You may not. It's not allowed. Hey, you should know what audience you're talking to, what they think, what their views are, or else your message won't get through. All this basic stuff. You should know what journalists are like, how they like to be approached, how they don't like to be approached. So we filled 2 days with this. It's just the beginning. And to tackle science communication with the public on the most contested scientific issue of today, climate change, there's so much more. This is just a very, very simple baseline. More specifically, we have to merge this practical how-to kind of stuff with the theory of science communication and the science of science communication. And that means what we're starting to learn from the social sciences about what motivates and drives people, including what drives them toward science resistance. And that leads to my second point. From now on, science communication strategies must be rooted in the science of science communication. And that's to quote Yale's Dan Kahan, who came up with that phrase. And a lot of his research is central to the science of science communication. So what does it show? Start with a simple study showing the effectiveness, of framing. Okay, so this is the same fake newspaper article containing the facts about global warming. It's caused by humans, happening now. Scientists have a consensus about this. Framed, and this is the experimental manipulation, two different headlines. Scientific panel recommends nuclear solution to global warming. Scientific panel recommends anti-pollution solution to global warming. This study just showed, by Kahan, that if you play this framing game and you get political conservatives, then they reject the facts much more in the anti-pollution frame than they reject the facts in the nuclear power frame. Okay? So that opens their mind, that closes their mind. Very simple, but this is the kind of thing that has to be always in mind as we try to reach the public. And it's just the beginning. This is the overarching framework that Kahan uses in order to explain this. He divides up people based upon two different ways in which they have different views about politics, two axes. One is how hierarchical are you? In other words, how much do you support various kinds of inequality based on class, race, gender, what have you, versus how egalitarian you are? And then how individualistic are you? How much do you think you should be able to go it alone without government getting in your way versus how communitarian you are? How much you think it takes a village and we're all in it together and government needs to protect? Republicans tend to live up here. Democrats tend to live down here. Of course, there are exceptions, but generally conservatives, Republicans are hierarchically individualistic and liberals or Democrats are more communitarian and egalitarian. All right, so what does this do? What does this do to people? In one study he performed, he created a fake scientific expert who said that global had good credentials, National Academy of Sciences member and all the rest, who said global warming is caused by humans, and they gave him a paragraph explaining why this is so. So if you live in the top left, then 23% of you think that that is a scientific expert. But if you live in the bottom right, 88% of you think it's a scientific expert. In other words, science for many of us is whatever we want it to be, whatever supports our worldview. The worldview comes first. And then we determine expertise itself on that basis. So the facts do not change minds. Shifting cultural meanings and understandings shape acceptance of facts. That's how it works. Which leads to point three. The scientific evidence shows that scientific evidence is rarely sufficient to change minds. Okay, that's just the beginning of the evidence demonstrating that. And to further demonstrate it, I want to give you something that drives you absolutely mad, but it's hard to resist. And this is the concept that a lot of people are what I call smart idiots. Okay? Sounds oxymoronic, maybe not so much. In other words, the more they know about something, the more they learn, the more they research, or the more educated they are, what have you, the more biased they become. And if they're biased in the wrong direction, the more wrong they become. Which goes in precisely the opposite way of what we think if we think the Enlightenment is a good thing and we have to give people facts in order to make them understand and believe and accept. That's what we all want to believe. Let me tell you how I learned about the smart idiot. It was this Pew data, 2008, and this is now in all over the social science literature on global warming, showing the relationship between political party affiliation, views about global warming, and level of education. And so what it shows is that if you're a Republican, then the higher your level of education, the less likely you are to accept scientific reality. Okay? But if you're a Democrat or independent, the higher your level of education is, the more likely you are to accept scientific reality. This is not just a conservative thing. What you get on vaccine denial is the same thing. The parents who believe that vaccines cause autism, they tend to have a higher level of education. They tend to be better off. They tend to empower themselves and go research the issue on the internet. And that's how they end up being so wrong. It also shows up in non-political areas. So this is data from John Sides of George Washington. Increased belief that President Obama is a Muslim. It grew between March 2009 to August 2010. Who did it grow among? Well, not just Republicans, but if you had some college or you were a college grad and you were a Republican, then the belief increased much more than if you had high school or less. And so when you get to something, you just have to say, like, what is going on with these people? But seriously, what's going on? The more capable you are of coming up with arguments to support your beliefs, the more you'll think you're right and the more you'll think you're clever and ingenious, and the less likely you will be to change. You'll come up with all kinds of new ways of reaffirming yourself. This is emotionally satisfying. And you're laying down pathways in your brain that you'll use again and again and again. It gets even worse, right? Because correcting people who believe wrong things also doesn't work a lot of the time. It doesn't stop them from being smart idiots. Another study of this, Brendan Nyhan, a political scientist at Dartmouth, he gave them fake newspaper articles that contained a wrong fact and then a correction of it. Okay, the wrong fact was Iraq has weapons of mass destruction or tax cuts increase government revenue. And he put these things in the mouth of George W. Bush, which was why he got the result that he did. Okay, so what happens if you give someone who believes these things the fact and then you correct it and then you see what they think? Have you guys seen Swingers? Somebody's seen. What happens if you get 11 in blackjack? You double down. That's what they do once the belief is refuted. They double down and they believe it even more strongly. Now, these kinds of denial are clearly political. Political values are getting in the way of people accepting what's true, and they're proving way more powerful than the information that you guys work so hard to create. Much of this is happening at a subconscious level. People don't even know they're doing it. They're just doing it. But it's not just values or morals or views of how society should be structured, as in Kahan's research. It's very important that it's not just that, though, that drives the kind of differential responses we see in the acceptance or rejection of science. There's something even deeper that makes us unable to understand each other and that drives the fight over what's true. That leads to point four. The evidence shows that liberals and conservatives are just different people, and most scientists are psychological liberals. When you get down to it, we think about ideology all wrong. We have a blank slate view. There are these two opposing philosophies, and people reach their views for intellectual reasons and thinking about the issues, and then they just think about them differently. That's not what ideology is at all. It is much more deeply rooted than that. All of the research suggests this. If our differences were purely the result of thinking rationally about the issues, okay, then why would differences between liberals and conservatives show up in how they organize their bedrooms? But they do. Liberals are messier. Conservatives are cleaner. Liberals have more books and magazines and travel guides and albums, and conservatives have, like, ironing boards and American flags, okay? And why would, this is all peer-reviewed research, right? Why would it show up in preferences for different kinds of art, with liberals liking abstract art more? Why would the two groups have different senses of humor? But they do, and there is actually a study about liberals and conservatives and how they view Colbert, and both think he's funny, but liberals think he's funny because they think he is a satire of conservatives, and conservatives think he's funny because he really agrees with them. I'm not joking, okay? This is what ideology is. It is much more than political views. And the differences go on and on. A scientist I worked with for part of the book, a political scientist named Everett Young, found in his research, conservatives are more likely than liberals to think the fans of rival sports teams are less likable people. They're more likely to want to keep germs out of their bodies. And they're more likely to elect a candidate to Congress who keeps his lawn neatly edged.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to author and science writer Chris Mooney as he investigates the mindset of denying science and climate change. This talk was recorded at the 2012 annual meeting of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science at AAAS.org.
So where do these differences live? Somewhere in the brain. And believe it or not, there are brain studies that show some differences. I want to be very cautious about this. This is actually a study that was commissioned by the British actor Colin Firth. Got into the scientific literature, but he asked for the study to be done because he said he wanted to figure out what was biologically wrong with the people who disagreed with him. Right? We don't want to go down that road, really, but that's actually what he said. And then he said, and believe it or not, they found something. Okay, they found, you know, somewhat more likely to have a larger right amygdala if you're conservative, and somewhat more likely to have more gray matter in the anterior cingulate if you're liberal, and this is all statistically significant. What does it mean? That's the issue, all right? I think we have to be very cautious with this kind of stuff. But we don't have to be cautious about is the research, the endless bodies of research that shows that personality is politics. And this is where the left-right differences are, I think, really hard to argue with. And this is probably the most important figure I'll show you. This is a Yale political scientists. There's the reference, 12,000 people figuring out how personality correlates with ideology. And what you got here is on the top, you got things that make you more likely to be liberal, and the bottom, things that make you more likely to be conservative. And you've got the five, big five personality traits, I'll tell you what they are, and then you got a comparison with level of income, level of education. All right, it's widely known, this is a sociological reality, more income makes you conservative, more education makes you liberal. So that's on there. But what it shows is that personality can be at least as big, and conscientiousness, which is liking order and structure and regularity, pushes you conservative. Openness, which is liking new ideas and trying new things, pushes you way liberal. Agreeableness is kind of split. Stability, which is the opposite of neuroticism, is more conservative. Extroversion, conservatives have more friends. So, what makes you liberal? Openness and education. What makes you conservative? Money and structure. Why do we disagree about reality? A lot of it's right here. Lack of openness. Why do we view the world so differently than conservatives in this room? A lot of it's right here. Education. This is what I think is really underlying things like the inability to accept what's true about global warming and the huge partisan gulf on the matter. And the implications of this are huge, not just for our intellectual adversaries, but for ourselves and how we think about things. We think about things in an ivory tower way. You know, there's a statistic, AAAS members, 2009, Pew study, 6% Republicans. And someone said, oh, well, we need more Republican scientists. I'm like, wait, no, this is kind of the way it works. Scientists are liberal because they have the openness and they're all interested in trying new things and figure out new ideas. They don't have a need for certainty and they're okay with nuance and they're okay with not knowing and they constantly got to change something. They're pushed in the same way that liberals are pushed. And so, of course, they love living in the academic world because this is like a playground for people who are open to experience, open to new ideas. And, of course, liberals have way more percentage of advanced degrees than conservatives do. This is a quote from a sociologist who studies it, just talking about how predominant the higher education difference is getting in dividing the left and the right. So we all know academia is liberal. We all know scientists are liberal. And now we know why, which leads to my fifth point. You cannot trust your instincts in communication. They are wrong because you're coming from this world. And your instincts are going to push you in the wrong direction, at least as soon as you try to communicate outside of that world. What instincts do we share from being in academia and being in science? Enlightenment instincts. The idea that you put the facts out there and everyone will debate them and we'll figure out what's true and what's false, and then we will make societal decisions and we will change for the better based upon the information. These assumptions are not universal, and in assuming that they are and in acting as if they are, we hobble ourselves in communication. Think about Fox News. Are they pursuing enlightenment assumptions or are they exploratory in their ideology the way those who are open to experience are, or are they defensive in their ideology? And when they are attacking global warming, is it because to accept it would be too hard? They're not trying to find out, you know, what the next study says and what the next study says in order to get as close as they can to reality. They're sowing doubt because the reality is something that really, really deep down threatens them and threatens who they are and how they view society and how it should be structured. And we can rant about this and we can get angry about it, but if we want to understand it, I think that's the context in which we have to think about it. Is there good news? My sixth point. Our great strength, scientists' great strength and liberals' great strength. I know not every scientist is a liberal, but the correlation is strong. The willingness to listen to evidence and change their ways. After all, this is openness to experience. Let's do something a little different. Well, let's do that in communication. These are some slogans that appeal to people who are open to experience. This is why you pay too much money for Mac computers, okay? But you're willing to do things differently. You're willing to change. So in communication, what is that going to mean? Let's get moving on doing things differently. We need to integrate the practical side of communication, the how-tos that I talked about before, with what the theory is starting to teach us about why people deny facts that are inconvenient, why liberals and conservatives are different. And then we need to apply that in the toughest areas, like climate. And we have to recognize that the future of science communication is going to lie in psychology and neuroscience. And we have to be ready for that. It's going to lie in figuring out precisely what kinds of narratives excite what kinds of emotions leading to what kinds of actions. And we're going to be able to study all of this. And we're going to be able to capture it. But the psychology research also, of course, shows that it's going to be so hard. I mean, let's be honest about it. Not only do we have to get moving, we have to do something even more difficult than that, which is stay the course once we get moving. Because a lot of what we know about people who deny things like climate science suggests that they've bolted the hatches down, all right? The issues are too political, too polarized. Getting easy progress is going to be extremely hard, but that doesn't mean we can't try to better ourselves, those of us who are willing to change. And because we're committed to trying new things and adjusting what we do based upon what's true, we need to realize a weakness that we have, which is we're always disagreeing with each other. We're always squabbling. We're always, you know, being contrary, attacking our colleagues, because we're trying to say, over here, I'm different. I've got a different idea. Okay, 1,000 flowers bloom. This leads to political ineffectiveness. And that's one thing to keep in mind. In his latest book, Hockey Stick in the Climate Wars, I'll end on this note, Mike Mann draws an analogy He talks about being in the Serengeti, and he talks about the strategy that zebras employ to prevent lions from killing them off one by one. And that is, they all stand together, so you can't tell which one the weak one is in the pack. And what Mann says is that that's exactly what is needed in climate communication since it's become such a war. It's the opposite of what comes naturally because of openness, because of the academic background. And maybe that's the problem, is learning to hold together, hold the course. That might be the most important, but also the hardest and most counterintuitive thing of all. Thanks.
That was science writer Chris Mooney speaking to the AAAS conference in Vancouver 2012. The first question is he just talking about anti-science in America? And what about the moderates? Should we even be calling it climate change if so many people fear change?
Do I think this is too U.S.-centric? No. There are definitely cultural variations in ideology. I mean, obviously. But actually, left-right appears all over the place. And the psychology research has been done on left-right all over, everywhere it appears. And it's consistent. Okay, so despite the cultural variability, you actually find the signal still in, if you look at European left-right, for example. And there's a lot of published studies that show that. I mean, left and right is rooted in psychology, is what I'm saying, at least partly. And so it keeps showing up. So these things are a spectrum, right? Obviously, there's a left-right spectrum, and even that is a little simplified to understand ideology, but it does capture a lot of the variability. So on the spectrum, you have independents and you have moderates, and they're not exactly the same thing. Because there's a lot of evidence that shows that openness to experience makes you more likely to be liberal and independent because you want to be different. The moderates who really fall in the middle, I think, are probably often a psychological blend. Open, but not extremely open. Conscientious, not extremely conscientious. So I think you might see a psychological continuum just like you see, to some extent, just like you see a political continuum. But yeah, those people are going to be more reachable. And one of the things about being in the middle is that you have to look at left and right. I mean, it's kind of the nature of it. So that means you have to kind of integrate. And integrative complexity is one of the traits that leads people to be more compromising. Another one of the psychological traits that's more on the left than the right, seeing different points of view. So in that sense, it's absolutely true that they should be more open. But you also have the problem of a lot of moderates and being just disengaged. And they actually might be psychological liberals or psychological conservatives, but they don't even know it because they don't know anything about the issues and their emotions haven't connected to the issues. So once they actually connect and get informed, they might turn out to be radical on one side or the other. And so a lot of the electorate's like that. Right, so right now, the issue is pushing that individualistic button, which is a moral button. And it's not lining up with this whole, we need to preserve stability and traditional culture and America as we've always known it, as the founding fathers wanted it, which is the sort of the anti-change, which actually has got a lot of positive aspects to it. At least it's a very successful message for conservatives when they talk about it that way. They're totally not fitting climate change into that mold. So why? Well, I mean, they've been told that it's not that. They've been told by all of the voices that they listen to that it is a threat to the individualistic value. So you have to get past that gigantic hurdle, which is incredibly emotional. And then, is there a possibility of reframing it? Well, I think when you look at the Pentagon caring about global warming, they're definitely trying to preserve stability, right? And they're not usually thought of as a liberal group, but they find it so destabilizing, and they're actually looking at the evidence that they're like, we've got to do something. We've got to head this off. There's potential there. But the cultural meanings that exist now are so, it's been framed in a way that riles the individualistic right up so much that you would have to somehow like get them to drop that. And you can't because you can't control the information they're getting from Fox and everyone else. So that's the real difficulty there.
That was author and science journalist Chris Mooney, recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock at the AAAS Science Conference in Vancouver, Canada, February 19, 2012. Find more links to Chris's blog and research in my blog at ecoshock.info. I recorded about 19 presentations at the event, sometimes with two recorders going at one time. I'll play you more cutting-edge discoveries about our world in upcoming EcoShock shows. Others require new interviews with key scientists. New information with serious implications is coming in so fast, we all need to privately educate ourselves. Just to understand how nature works, what we are allowed and not allowed to do, what we can't get away with. and what we can do to preserve a livable world for our kids and for our grandchildren and descendants. I'm Alex Smith. Visit our website at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for listening and caring about your world.